Accession number 30407, Mr. Ralph Curtin, Reel 9. Now, I think we're now moving on to this business of Cooper Force. And can you explain exactly what happened? Because this is operations in January of 1951. And it's basically in the Happy Valley area. But it's a particular series of operations that happened, and I think we haven't quite certain, but it was on the 4th of January, the big thing. But can you explain the lead up to it as you remember it?
Well, as I remember it, Captain Ashley Cooper, he went up a couple of times during the day, and the third time we went up, incidentally, before give you some background to this. It had taken the sappers and quite a lot of manpower, 48 hours, to make some sort of track so that the Cromwells could get into the position that they eventually got into.
Now, where is this? Can you explain it? Or is it difficult? Is it in Happy Valley?
It is on the edge of Happy Valley, forward.
And what was the situation as you understood it?
It was extremely dodgy getting the Cromwells into position. The weather wasn't very, very good. And eventually we managed to, the tanks managed to get into position. And then I went back with Ashley Cooper for an OP, and then eventually we returned late afternoon, and I was left on this track while he went forward to the...
Tell me about what happened when he went up to the OP post beforehand. Do you remember anything happening then, or did you just drop him off?
I just dropped him off, and he was there for some while. Then he came back, and I ran him back down to where the tanks were. And to be perfectly honest, the situation developed later on. I should have returned to HQ, in actual fact, but I was asked to stay on in case he wanted to nip somewhere else. And I did so... Eventually, it got extremely dark, and I thought, well, I'm not going back, so I better make the most of it. And I tried to find some sort of shelter.
Now, what was happening to...
Well, things started to liven up. I always remember it was a beautiful moonlight night. It really was. It was clear, a beautiful moon shining. And then we started getting a lot of static on the radios and that, about a lot of troops massing in front. And there was the air was alive with static of calls and replies and so on and so
forth. Whose calls are they? Are these the British ones?
These are the British ones, yes. And one became really aware that something out of the ordinary was going on. And then, of course, we were told that the clusters were being hit, the fusiliers were being hit. And later on, all hell broke loose. The tanks were firing as fast as they could. There was mortar support. The RA batteries were firing. There was parachute flares going up all over the place. And then suddenly, without any warning at all, we were being fired on.
Now, who's we?
Well, the B echelon of which I was part of, and we looked to see where the where this firing was coming from, and as we went into this valley position, on the left hand side, there was quite a high piece of ground overlooking the track, and the firing was coming from there. And we, first of all, we couldn't understand it, and then we realised that we were being fired on by the enemy. There was a sergeant who came up and said, "Well, you're going to have to do something about this." And I had at that time a brain gun, and I obviously got it out and put it in position. I jumped down the side of a bank. There was where the road was. There was this banking, and I got down through behind the bank to give me some cover. But I could see all these, this ridge line where all these firing was coming from. I could see this sort of, every now and again you'd see different colours of flashing blue and green colours.
It's artillery fire?
No, this was small arms fire.
No artillery fire, then?
Not then. And of course, broke out the brain, started to return the fire, and immediately, as soon as I started firing, I realised that I was giving the position away, because the British idea of starting with anyway was to every fourth or fifth bullet you put a tracer in, and as soon as you fired the tracer, they spotted where you were. That wasn't healthy at all. That wasn't healthy. That brought down a lot of trouble. So we. To be honest, I was very cagey about loosening off too many rounds. And then they brought in some mortars. They started using mortars, which gave us a lot of trouble. A lot of trouble.
What was it like being under mortar fire?
To be honest, frightening. Shrapnel whipping about all over the place. One tends to try and keep your head down, if possible, without not being able to see what's going on. But it's very intense, and you never get used to it. But you do your best to try and support you, all your team, as best you can. And then... the order came down, it got very, very bad, and the order came down that all B vehicles should try and get out. Now, in front of me was a... had come in behind me, an American half-track that was an ambulance half-track. There was quite a lot of people came through, and we found there was quite a lot of people injured, and there was an orderly corporal who was putting these people into this half track. And until he moved, I couldn't go. It had taken me in the Jeep, I would think, a good hour to get into this position. And there was a lot of firing going on, a lot of movement. And then we had the order that they were going to break out. So
were you completely surrounded?
Oh, completely. Yeah, we were completely cut off. They'd come down off this low hill to our left and got round the back of us. Quite a lot of them milling about. So... it was deemed that we would do our best and try and get out if possible. And there was a 1,500 weight in front, with some soldiers and some wounded in the back. Then this half track, and myself in the Jeep. And the idea was that the chaps in the front would... try and burst through whatever was in our way, if possible. And certainly, if the 1,500 weight got knocked out, then the half track certainly could make it out. hopefully anyway. And we started off and we went through a couple of small villages which were full of these Chinese and that. And basically we just kept going, firing as we went through these places. And eventually we got out. We came round a bend in the track and we were hit by this great big searchlight. And what it turned out to be, it was an American Sherman with this big floodlight on the top. And that was how we got out. More with luck than anything, really.
Now, what had happened to the rest of it? Because that's the B echelon, isn't it?
This is the B echelon.
Now, what had happened to the forward elements?
Well, the forward elements we found out afterwards, because one or two of the chaps did get through, that the tanks were given the... They kept firing and kept firing until they were virtually out of ammunition. And then the order was given from Ashley Cooper, said to get out, if possible. And they apparently they started out, and a couple of them lost tracks, and they became immobilised. And then, of course, they were surrounded, and they were being sticky bombed by these Chinese, brewing up the tanks. And several of them managed to get out, but then were injured or captured in the process of trying to break out. None of the tanks made it in various shapes and forms. They fell off the road, shed tracks, had problems, had to abandon the tanks. And it was just chaotic. Everything erupted. It was one hell of a battle. But they certainly took a lot of people down. They did extremely well. But then, of course, quite a lot of the boys went in the bag, were captured.
And Astley Cooper?
They never saw him again. Never saw him again. I think I was the last... apart from a radio message, I think I was the last person to see him alive, as far as I know.
So what happened then? I mean, what state were you in when you got back?
Relieved to have got out, to be honest. I really didn't think I would make it. There was so much going on all around. And then, to my own surprise, I managed to bring out a Jeep. Apart from a few scratches and wings folded up where we did things on the way out, there wasn't a lot of damage to it. And I was pleased because on the way out we picked up quite a few of the Ulsters. Managed to cling on the side. There were three chaps hanging onto my Jeep, which I was grateful to be able to do. Looking back, I think I was extremely lucky. In fact, I know I was, considering the amount of stuff that was going on.
Anything else you remember before we move on? I mean, I know you've covered it very well there, but is there any other sort of aspect of it that just comes to mind? Perhaps we haven't covered yet.
I think the suddenness from being a composite unit into scattering all over the place, and the way that they managed to infiltrate around us, from their point of view, was extremely well done. From our point of view, we couldn't understand how it had happened until the full story came out of how many troops had been thrown against us and what had transpired.
There were a lot.
There were an awful lot. And the fact being that prior to the engagement, battle patrol groups had gone 10, 15 miles, apparently, into the forward ground, and nothing had been seen. Nothing. And yet suddenly, out of the blue, thousands.
So it's a total surprise.
Total surprise. And we found out afterwards that when they attacked in three waves. Apparently the first wave was fully armed. The second wave was armed every now and again. And the third wave picked up whatever they could and carried on fighting. And we do know that they were doped. They apparently were high on something. They just appeared not to feel any pain. I mean, they were knocked down in dozens, and yet those that still survived, who weren't here, just kept coming. You're unbelievable.
Now, what happened next then? You got back. You'd escaped.
I escaped.
You've been lucky.
I escaped, I got out, and we were directed back down the MSR to where HQ was, and we had to report back and be signed to be checked out that we're safe, so that they could estimate what had happened to the rest of the outfit. So that was the, as far as I was concerned, that was the... my biggest battle anyway, as far as being into Happy Valley and being cut off and having escaped, got out.
Now, that had been your unit, you know, yes. I mean, you were part of Cooper Force. What, Cooper was dead, Astley Cooper was dead, or presumed dead, I presume, at that time.
He
was dead.
He was never captured, he was never found or seen again.
But I presume no one knew particularly well. No. So what happened back at the unit? I mean, were you reorganised or...?
Well, we were interviewed by the senior officers.
Do you remember that? What was the debrief?
Yes, they asked what had happened, what we saw. I presume they kept a war diary, most regiments do. And we just told it as I, more or less as I explained it to you. They seemed quite pleased that at least some of us had got out to be able to explain what had happened. And of course later on when things were analysed, they realised how it had happened. Cooper Force as such just ceased to exist.
So what were you put in then? You know.
Well, I was then I was then attached to I was in Recce Force at the time. In Recce, that's why we were with Cooper Force, but I then was assigned to a Dingo Scout car as forward observations. That, in actual fact, got permission from the colonel to campaign the rest of the time with my brother, Corporal Dennis Curtin. So we were in a dingo called Hastings.
So you formed a crew with your brother?
With my brother, Corporal Dennis Curtin. He was in charge.
And your dingo was called Hastings?
Hastings.
Now, tell me a bit about tell me about the dingo first. We've talked about it before, but now you're actually really going to, this is going to be what you do.
Oh, it was a Daimler Scout car. It would go backwards as fast as it would go forwards. Quite a very smart, low-slung vehicle. It could do 50, flat out. It carried a Bren gun, it carried an M1, I'd acquired an M1 by then. We had grenades, smoke grenades, 16 set. And our job was...
Hang on. Now, what did you think? Was it a good machine?
It was a good machine. Yes, one had to keep it warm. You know, this period in the depth of winter, one had to keep that as warm.
It's still January.
Yeah. You had to keep it warm.
And any other faults or advantages of it?
Well, once the engine was running, of course, you got some sort of heat coming from the engine, which helped at times. What we did was we lifted the plates, and what was happening was Chinese had started putting down a lot of anti-tank mines, and we lifted the plates, the floor plates, and put some sandbags down in underneath the footwell to try and give us some sort of protection. Thinking back on it, if we'd have hit one, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway.
And what were the crew roles? Were there just the two of you?
Just the two of us.
So what did you do? What did he do? What did you do?
Well, he was tank commander. He was responsible for directions as to where we went from command, how far forward, and my responsibility was keeping it mechanically running and driving it and doing other things. The brain gunner was my responsibility.
So what would he use, the M1?
In actual fact, what we did in the finish, I managed to scrounge a 0.5 off the Americans, and I got the REME to weld a pivot post on it. We mounted it that way, which gave us a hell of a lot of firepower.
You got the ammunition as well?
Oh yes, plenty of that.
And this was which gun? The point five.
Point five.
Did it have a name?
Browning.
Just a point five. Browning.
Yeah.
And what was that like as a weapon?
Oh, terrific! Hell of a rate of fire.
Was it reliable?
Yes.
Wouldn't jam.
Yeah. So if you looked after it, which you've got to do these.
Now, were you still with the recce?
Yes.
Thing.
I mean, we were in the C squadron. We were a recce troop of HQ squadron attached to C squadron. So we did all the recces for C squadron going forward or whatever. Little story attached to that was one day we went out on recce. We'd been going about 2 or 3 miles and we could hear this noise, and it sounded familiar, and I couldn't make out what it was. Anyway, we kept going, and we were getting louder and louder, and we crept round this bend, and we stuck out, just had a quick sneak round the bend, and you wouldn't believe it, but there was this 1500 bait, a great hole in the road, and out of the back of this 100 bait was a snaking tube going down into this hole. And I kept my brother covered with 0.5 in case it was some sort of trap or something, and he crawled forward and stuck his head over the top. And believe it or not, there was a sapper in the bottom with a pneumatic drill. And Dennis said, my brother said to him, what the are you doing down there doing this? And he said, his instructions were to go along this road, and if there were any holes he found, was to fill them in. And he was 3 or 4 miles in the front of the front line. He bit his sapper. Incredible. We told him to fill it in and get out of there a bit lively.
So, it's just, now, tell me about your role. You had an OP role, didn't you?
Yes. Yes. We observed, we went up on one of the hills, got in a position, and my brother could see these enemy battle patrol, I presumed it was, coming across, and he called down, got through to the regiment on the reg, and told what was happening, and they asked if he would vector open fire for them onto them. So he acted as an OP. Did quite well, actually. He certainly landed amongst them.
Did you know how to do the, you know, the bracketing, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I was a trained gunner.
You'd learnt all that, then?
Well, yeah. I spent a lot of time doing that.
So, so what happened next, then? I mean, what sort of OP work were you doing? What do you remember about those trips going out an OP?
Well, they were attached to, if you were an OP, you were attached to a unit, and you went up on the hill, and you stayed with them until you were told otherwise. And you were in direct contact with RHA batteries, and when called upon, you directed the fire. Right, left, up, down, whatever, and whatever they wanted, whether they wanted HE, which is mostly what they wanted anyway. If you saw tanks or anything like that, which we very seldom did anyway, the only time we did see a tank was one of the captured Cromwells. I think I told you about that, on the Han River. It was in one of the floodgates. We knocked that out anyway.
I don't think we've actually recorded that.
No?
No.
Oh. Well, that was...
It doesn't look like it. No, we haven't.
We had a call. We were on recce, and we had a call from some troops to say that artillery piece was firing at them, and they think it was coming from one of the floodgates on the banks of the Han River. And... we went and had a look, and we then found it as such. It was firing through one of the slots in the floodgates, and it turned out to be a Cromwell. And the colonel, we came upon the net and spoke to the colonel about it. He was very interested. And he said he ordered his own tank out. This was Colonel Loweth, Baronet. And he said, right, this one's mine. And eventually the Centurion turned up, and I think about the third shot they knocked it out. It went up and would have been poof, gone. And that was that. That I showed you that picture of
me. You did show me the picture.
We were cleaning the barrels out. Afterwards, yeah.
Now, when you were attached, you were attached to infantry units, were you?
Yes.
How did you get on with them when you were attached to them, you know? Cause
a good bunch of boys, really. British boys.
Were they all British units?
Yeah. Well, the old studs, of course.
And how did they treat you? I mean, you know,
very well, very well. They thought it was good to have somebody alongside them who they could call on to give them some real good support and close in if necessary, which we did.